Good morning. It's Friday, July 18th. I'm Shumita Basu. This is Apple News Today. On today's show, the Supreme Court keeps issuing emergency rulings in Trump's favor. Millions of undocumented immigrants aren't eligible for bond hearings anymore. And Stephen Colbert makes a big announcement. But first, the House approved $9 billion in cuts to foreign aid and public media that both chambers of Congress had previously agreed to spend. Yesterday, we spoke about how those cuts will impact public media. Today, let's focus on how the bulk of that money, about $8 billion, was earmarked for global health programs and emergency food aid. It's the first time in over 25 years Congress has approved a rescission request for the president to cancel already approved funding. Congress members typically have closely guarded their power over federal spending. But over the course of Trump's second term, members of his administration, led by White House Budget Director Russell Vogt, have aimed to give the executive branch more control. In this case, Vogt, along with Elon Musk's Doge team, argued to lawmakers that cuts were necessary to combat what they've described as waste, fraud, and abuse. That message resonated with many lawmakers who ultimately supported the package, including Republican Senate Majority Leader John Thune, who praised their work before the Senate approved the bill on Wednesday.
I appreciate all the work the administration has done in identifying wasteful spending. And now it's time for the Senate to do its part to cut some of that waste out of the budget.
But exactly how much waste, fraud, and abuse did Vogt and the Doge team really find when they evaluated foreign aid? NPR took a closer look and spoke with six officials at USAID and the State Department who had direct knowledge of how these reviews were conducted. All six said a thorough review process didn't happen. Instead, they said Trump officials and Doge staff members searched for keywords in the descriptions of foreign aid programs, and if they found words like gender or family planning, climate or equality, that program was flagged to be cut. In other words, as one official put it to NPR health correspondent Fatma Tanis, the review may have focused more on how much a program aligned with Trump's agenda, rather than measuring its effectiveness or identifying potential improper spending.
These officials told me that the dismantling of the agency happened so quickly, it was not possible for any actual investigation to happen in that chaos.
Many of the examples of allegedly wasteful spending Trump officials have presented to lawmakers and the public in recent months have not been backed up by evidence, including these comments Vogt made to senators last month when testifying about cuts to foreign aid.
Americans have been funding the following: $5.5 million to LGBTQ advocacy in Uganda, $800,000 for transgender people, sex workers, and their clients in Nepal, $3.6 million for LGBTQ activism, free training in pastry cooking, psychosocial counseling, a cyber cafe, and the dance focus groups for male prostitutes in Haiti.
Again, he did not provide documentation to back up those claims or others he made in testimony. And when NPR reached out to his office to ask for evidence, Tanis received no response. The State Department, however, told her their review process was exhaustive, and it said each program was reviewed individually. NPR also reached out to Paul Martin, who used to be USAID's inspector general under Biden, in charge of looking out for things like waste, fraud, and abuse at the agency. He was fired by Trump in February, shortly after the president started rapidly dismantling USAID. Martin told NPR no one from Trump's team or the Doge team contacted him with concerns about spending.
As far as I know, never once has anybody in Doge or in the new administration referred to the IG's office criminal allegations of fraud, waste, or abuse. Frankly, the handful of examples I'm aware of were just completely made up.
Now to the Supreme Court and how the Trump administration is scoring big wins in cases through a system that largely keeps decisions out of the public eye, the emergency appeals process, also known as the shadow docket. Bloomberg Supreme Court reporter Lydia Wheeler told us about it.
Basically, every time the Trump administration loses a court challenge in a lower court, what they do is they rush up to the Supreme Court and they say, hey, justices, we need you to let us like implement the policy that we're trying to implement while we still fight whether it's legal in court.
It's called the shadow docket because these cases typically have no full briefings, oral arguments, or signed opinions, and rulings are not explained the way a typical Supreme Court decision is. So the public gets very little information on how the court reached a decision. This process is designed for questions that need a fast answer, like prisoners wanting a stay of execution. It usually determines whether a specific policy can go into effect, not whether it's legal. And decisions are intended to be temporary while a lower court considers the case in more detail. But often, during that period, things can happen that can be hard to reverse later. An example of that came this week when the court's conservative majority ruled in favor of Trump's efforts to make big cuts at the Department of Education.
The Supreme Court said you don't have to reinstate 1,400 employees of the Education Department that you had cut, which a lower court had told him he had to do.
The lawsuit challenging those cuts argued Trump did not have the authority to do this or to scale back the Education Department at large because the department was created by Congress, so only Congress can dismantle it. Lower courts are still deciding if Trump's plans here are legal, but critics argue this shadow docket ruling effectively clears the way for Trump to dismantle the department anyway, because these cuts alone account for roughly half of its workforce.
People quickly looked at that decision and said, wait a minute, this same court just 2 years ago said to the Biden administration, no, you can't cancel millions of dollars in student loan debt, that you don't have the authority to do that. So they're saying, like, how is it possible that the Trump administration has the authority to completely dismantle the Education Department? And without any explanation, it's hard to see what's the difference between those two cases.
Trump also used this approach to get approval to fire federal workers en masse, ban transgender people from the military, and deport migrants to countries that are not their countries of origin.
And the more that the Supreme Court rules in favor of the Trump administration, legal scholars say that it invites other people, other litigants, to also come to the court the minute they lose at the lower court and try to appeal.
Now, emergency appeals aren't new. Every president for the past 20 or so years has made them. President Biden on more than a dozen occasions.
But no president has done it to this extreme, this often, in every case they're losing.
And few presidents have had the opportunity to do it with a court that they single-handedly reshaped.
President Trump, during his first term in office, was able to dramatically shift the court further to the right with three appointments and really solidify a 6-3 conservative majority. And so far, it seems, and the legal scholars say, that this is playing in his favor. So this is why people are saying that it's making the court look really partisan, and it's hurting them reputationally as an institution.
Now to immigration and how the Trump administration is trying to speed up deportations for people they suspect to be in the U.S. illegally to meet the president's goal of deporting 1 million people in his first year. Washington Post immigration reporter Maria Sacchetti has been following this.
The Trump administration has departed from a very common practice. Normally, after someone in the interior of the United States, say Nebraska or Northern California, is arrested for civil immigration violations, they can be detained in immigration facilities. But generally, they're eligible to ask for a bond hearing. They could be released on bail. Then they can be with their families, they can work, and they can meet with their lawyers, crucially, so that they can build a case against being deported.
But the administration has now decided these immigrants are no longer eligible for bond hearings. In rare cases, someone might be released on parole, but Sacchetti reports that decision will be up to an immigration officer, not a judge. Lawyers told her this policy change will impact millions of people who cross the U.S.-Mexico border over the past few decades.
The folks we're talking about here are folks who have been here a long time, and lawyers for immigrants argue have some defenses against being deported, but that's very difficult to build a case when you're detained.
And it can take months, even years, for removal proceedings to play out. The acting director of ICE has acknowledged the policy will likely face legal challenges. But people who support the administration's mass deportation goals have long argued that detaining people in this way is necessary to enforce final orders of removal and get people out of the country quickly.
You have hundreds of thousands of people with final deportation orders, but generally they're very difficult to find, you know, once they're in the country.
Meanwhile, as all of this plays out, the immigration court system is shrinking, which could make it less capable of handling these cases. Over the last 6 months, the Justice Department fired at least 50 immigration judges, and around that same number resigned after DOJ offered voluntary resignation buyouts in its efforts to reduce the federal workforce. So that means today there are about 14% fewer immigration judges nationwide compared to the start of Trump's term. And their workload is growing. There's a backlog of nearly 4 million immigration cases right now. The recently passed Republican tax and spending bill hopes to address this. Congress gave over $3 billion to the DOJ for immigration, which includes money for hiring and training more judges to address this backlog. But NPR reports it's not clear how the DOJ plans to replace these judges, and the process of training will take some time. Meanwhile, there are no signs the administration plans to slow down detentions. In fact, the tax and spending bill aims to help ICE roughly double the nation's current detention capacity to 100,000 a day. Before we let you go, a few other stories we're following. The Department of Justice has recommended a one-day prison sentence for the former police officer convicted in connection with the botched raid that killed Breonna Taylor. Taylor died in 2020 in Louisville, Kentucky, when police came to her apartment looking for her ex-boyfriend, who was not there. Her then-boyfriend said he thought police were intruders and shot at them, prompting return fire, which hit Taylor. Brett Hankison was convicted of violating Taylor's civil rights when he fired 10 shots through Taylor's window and door. None of those shots hit her, but the jury determined that he used excessive force, and his conviction carried a maximum life sentence. The two officers who fired the fatal shots were not charged. The DOJ criticized the prosecution made under the Biden administration, but Taylor's family attorney described the new recommendation as an insult to the life of their daughter. President Trump has been diagnosed with chronic venous insufficiency, a condition of circulation where the legs struggle to deliver blood back to the heart. In a rare nod to his age, his press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, described it as a benign and common condition for people in their 70s. Trump is 79. Some people started raising questions about his health after Trump appeared at the FIFA Club World Cup final with visibly swollen legs and a bruised hand covered in makeup. And finally, at last night's taping of The Late Show on CBS, host Stephen Colbert had an announcement.
Next year will be our last season. The network will be ending The Late Show in May. And yeah, I share your feelings.
Colbert said it was not just the end of his role hosting the show, but the end of The Late Show itself. Colbert said he only found out on Wednesday night and expressed gratitude to CBS. Only days before, he had some harsh words for Paramount, CBS's parent company, for their decision to settle the lawsuit brought by Trump over its 60 Minutes interview with Kamala Harris.
The corporation released a statement where they said, "You may take our money, but you will never take our dignity. You may, however, purchase our dignity for the low, low price of $16 million. We need the cash."
CBS says that the decision was purely financial and in no way related to, quote, other matters at Paramount. Colbert has hosted the show for nearly a decade, taking over following a 22-year run from David Letterman. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the News app right now, stick around for the latest episode of Apple News in Conversation. This week, I sat down with New York Times culture critic Amanda Hess to talk about her journey into parenthood and the dizzying digital world of apps, gadgets, and influencers she discovered.
Every time you look at your phone, you will get more advice about your kid, whether you're really looking at that or not. And I think what the drumbeat suggests is that our children and their emotions can be controlled and managed and optimized in this way if you just like absorb enough of the advice and you implement enough of the tips.
If you're listening in the podcast app, follow Apple News in Conversation to find that episode. Enjoy your weekend, and I'll be back with the news on Monday.